Session number 12907.
was a bash for drill tool.
So we couldn't always get out of the tank for sometimes 3 to 4 days at a time. One would urinate into an empty shell case, and that would be tipped over the side of the turret to take care of itself. The other bodily functions, you sometimes had to get out of the tank at a quiet moment, but you couldn't walk away from the tank track itself because of the possibility of mines. So one would have to walk back down the narrow tank track, defecate as quickly as possible, and scramble back into the tank. Now, this was all right on the first or second day, but it meant that on succeeding days, everybody had to walk further and further away from the tank to find a clean spot. One of the impressions of Normandy was that in those days there was an awful lot of toilet paper just sculling about the fields and stuck in the hedgerows. So we could eat inside the tank. You could bring your little petrol stove inside onto the turret of the tank and brew up tea, and you could eat cold bully beef and biscuits and tin jam and tin marmalade. So one could eat all right, but you couldn't wash, obviously, and you couldn't clean your teeth. But I must say that smoking was the comfort that most people had. It was very rare not to find the smoker. And you had to be very careful about your cigarette ration. You had to ration it carefully. Water and food was invariably there in just sufficient quantity. But cigarettes were always a problem. If you did run out of cigarettes, it wasn't unknown, in fact, to unravel all the butt ends and to re-roll them in a bit of toilet tissue paper. But anyway, we got by. But it was always the most blessed relief, in fact, to hear that you were going to be relieved and you could get back and have a wash and clean your teeth. Shaving didn't worry you quite so much, you got used to it by then. But when you did have a shave and you felt nice and clean afterwards, and you put together a meal, and you went to sleep on the ground for a long period.
It all sounds horrific, being in a tank.
Well, it was boredom, long periods of boredom and getting very uncomfortable. If it was dry, that was all right. If it was wet and raining, then invariably you got wet inside in patches. You didn't get wet overall. The crew commander would probably get quite wet if he was constantly on the lookout of the tank. But in those long periods of waiting, we did in fact change the watch station. So the crew commander would sit on the gunner seat and the gunner would take over for 2 hours and then the wireless operator to relieve that part. But if it rained, water would drip in through the periscope hatch or through the open hatch and around the gun mantlet ring, so you got wet in patches. You had one very, very wet leg and one dry leg. Or your back was very, very wet, but your chest wasn't wet. And eventually you sort of dried out. The worst realization, I think, was that the tank you were sitting in was far from being as secure and safe as you thought it was when one first joined up. And even when one was talking to gunnery instructors at the training camp, and you said, "Well, what happens, corporal, if the tank is hit?" "Oh," would the corporal say, "there'll be a loud bang and a big red glowing on the inside of the turret and lots of sparks." And he said, "That will be it." And we thought, well, that's quite reassuring. It's only when I joined the 3rd County London Yeomanry and started to listen to these other men who had come right the way twice, they'd swept backwards and forwards through Libya and Egypt, They'd come up through Sicily landings and into Italy. It's only when they start to talk about what actually happens when a tank is hit that one realised that you weren't very safe inside at all. And when we had our briefing going over on the tank landing craft about what we'd find when we got to Normandy, the military intelligence assessments that most of the armour was Panther tanks raised a great gloom and despondency, because the Panthers, with their high velocity guns, I mean, the gun calibre was the same, 75mm, as the Sherman, but the muzzle velocity was quite ferocious compared to the Sherman's muzzle velocity. And a Panther 75mm and, of course, the Tiger 88mm, if it opened fire at fairly close range, that's 800 yards, which is still half a mile away, the armour-piercing shot would go in one side of the turret of Sherman and exit out the other without stopping. Except that when it went through, of course, it killed the turret crew, or, you know, killed two out of three of them. So you soon had this awful realisation that a Sherman tank was under-armoured against the German Mark IVs and the Panthers and the Tigers. So after we'd landed in Normandy with our first Sherman tanks, replacement tanks came up which had applique armour on the outside, so that on the more vulnerable places, that is guarding the ammunition bins and on the front of the turret where the gunner was sitting, there was a 1-inch added layer of applique armour. But seeing this was psychological, that it gave you a more comforting feeling, but in fact it didn't really reduce the possibility that if a tank was hit by an armour-piercing shot, it would be perforated. So, and the other aspect that we didn't like was the fact we had petrol-engined Sherman tanks. And these were Sherman tanks which had a curious 9-cylinder Wright aircraft radial engine in the back, which ran on high octane gasoline. And these were very flammable. And the Germans, in fact, christened the Shermans Tommy cookers because of the ease with which they caught fire with a single penetrating shot. That was alleviated later on when a lot of these petrol engine Shermans were displaced with diesel engine Shermans, where the flammability was a bit lower.
How late did they come in?
Well, I think I remember that they came in when we were by that time up in Holland. But they were mixed. I mean, they're pretty mixed, the Sherman variants. There were so many variants with engine differences that it just so happened that the 3rd County London Yeomanry had petrol engine Shermans when they first went over there. But having got over there, the sister regiment to the 3rd County London Yeomanry, which was the 4th County London Yeomanry, was part of the 7th Armour Division, which tried to push through to Villers-Bocage maybe as early as June the 10th, were hit very decisively. And this is a tank engagement that people are very familiar with. The German tank commander, whose name was Wittmann, in his Tiger 88, picked off the leading tank of the 4th County London Yeomanry column, picked off the first tank, is said to motor down the column, picked off the last tank, and having immobilised the front at the beginning, then proceeded to immobilise the rest of the tanks. So the 4th County London Yeomanry had a rather nasty shock. Its commanding officer, who used to live quite near here, of course, the Earl of Clandon, was taken prisoner, as were a lot of the 4th. And the 3rd and 4th County London Yeomanry were then amalgamated into one unit. This meant that I, being a recent member of the 3rd, was transferred out, and I then joined the 44th Royal Tank Regiment, still in the same armoured brigade.
We'll come on to this more later. If we can go back, you were talking about the waterproofing of the Sherman tanks.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that involved?
Yes, it was rather a curious coincidence, because I have mentioned that I was working as a clerk before I went to the army in Shawmack's house in the Petroleum Board. And Shawmack's and BP Limited did have a contract to make waterproofing compound. And this was called Compound 219, at that moment a secret. But Compound 219 was simply called that because that was the room number of the general manager of the department in which I was working. And as a clerk, I'd heard of Compound 219 and the secret discussions going on, and how they were having technical problems in getting the right electrical resistivity into the compound, which in itself was only a calcium-based grease, but loaded with asbestos fibre. So it wasn't until I arrived down at Worthing that I saw enormous tins, enormous piles of Compound 219. And this was simply a rather, not hard, but a medium grease with lots of fibre in it, sufficiently, a bit like putty, which you applied around any particular crack or crevice in the Sherman tank. So that Sherman tanks had an escape hatch in the floor of the tank itself, through which the driver and co-driver could escape. That was not hinged, but it dropped out. But when it was secure, obviously it wasn't waterproof. So that was where the Compound 219 was placed around into the cracks. The engine inspection doors were sealed with Compound 219. As you went up the hull, the turret ring was sealed with a type of plastic covering and tape. The gun mantlet was sealed, and of course the gun barrel was sealed. And these ceilings had little explosive charges attached to them, which ran back inside the tank. The theory being was that as the tank came off the tank landing craft and rolled out the beach, the gunner or the crew commander inside could activate these charges and blow away the waterproofing membranes that would inhibit the rotation of the turret. As it so happened, when we did get off the tank landing craft, which was on D plus one, we then motored inland for about a mile and leaguered up and took all the waterproofing off by hand. But all tank crews had in fact spare containers of Compound 219 hanging on their tanks. And the other funny recollection about Normandy is that apart from seeing all the spare toilet paper that used to float around the fields, was the discarded tins of Compound 219.
But why did you take it off by hand instead of by the method approved?
Well, by that time, the explosive removal method was only in the case of coming off the tank landing craft and having to fire as you came off the beach. Whereas this wasn't necessary, it was thought, I suppose, a bit safer to remove it by hand and put it out for proper disposal.
Was it easy to get off?
Oh, yes, you just pulled it off, yes. It was just sealing tape with lots of 219 over it. It was messy and sticky, but it worked all right.
Now, I interrupted your narrative quite a while back with you heading down to Portsmouth, I think, getting ready for D-Day. Could you pick up the story in as much detail as you can from there, please?
Yes. The regiment, the 3rd County London Yeomanry, headed west out of Worthing. A big turnout, obviously, from the Worthing civilians, who had, I think, been very hospitable to the regiment as a whole. It was rumoured that there was no beer left in Worthing on that by that day, because the regiment had drunk it dry the previous night, so I'm told. But as we moved out of Worthing and pulled clear of Worthing and came up and over the South Downs, you could look forward and every inch of road for miles ahead was full of military vehicles, just moving slowly forward. If you look behind, there were miles of military vehicles heading towards that Solent area. I can't remember how long it took us. I think it took us a day and a bit, because we stopped overnight and waited and started off the next day. When we arrived in that area somewhere, we went into an enormous barbed wire camp from which you could not move at all. You were not allowed out. There was no contact whatsoever. And we were there, I think, for maybe 2 days and two nights when we moved out and went down to somewhere along the Portsmouth beach, where there were concrete ramps going down to this great collection of tank landing craft. So you drove on the tank landing craft. I think it was four tanks and one soft vehicle. It might have been six tanks and one soft vehicle on each tank landing craft. And we then pulled away from the shore and went out on the east side of the Isle of Wight. And one was absolutely amazed at the sheer volume of vessels of all shapes and sizes that were moving slowly outwards, all protected by barrage balloons. And one thought, well, this operation can't possibly fail because there's such an enormous weight of material moving forwards. And we'd taken our seasickness pills by then. We'd each been given a little survival pack, which unfortunately we weren't allowed to hold on to after we'd landed. But that was quite good, the survival pack. It had nice silk maps in of France and the Low Countries and a compass and little bits of high-energy condensed food. But we weren't allowed to keep it. I think also there might have been some money in there, French francs as well. So we were given these packs, and away we went slowly. Each tank landing craft had a naval officer and a naval, if it wasn't a rating, it might have been a petty officer. So two naval men per vessel. And the Shermans obviously were chained to the deck, but with the movement of the boat, they would sort of move backwards and forwards a few inches. So it went clank, 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 and away we went. I'd taken my seasickness pills, and I did feel seasick, but not very much. And we then had the briefing from the troop leader as to what it was all about and what we're going to find when we got there, this tale about the Panthers. And away we went. We sailed through that day and we sailed through that night. So we left on June the 6th and sailed through the night of June the 6th. Halfway or somewhere across, there was some motor torpedo boat activity and there was something going on which we couldn't quite discern. And then as it broke light on the morning of June the 7th, we could see the French coast that was misty to some extent. It was slightly grey and overcast. It wasn't bright and sunny at all. But black clouds arising, of course, from the beach and around the area. But we must have arrived a bit east of where we should have been, because all of a sudden we all turned westwards and ran parallel to the beach for what seemed quite a long time, half an hour maybe, getting more apprehensive. And then somehow the tank landing craft turned towards the beach and we then realised that we'd arrived.
What's it like being in one of these tank landing crafts?
Well, when you're not in the tank, but in the tank landing craft, of course, it's wet and damp. I mean, there's lots of spray coming over the front. You could only eat dry rations. I mean, you couldn't cook on board, anything like that. So you could only eat dry rations and drink cold water. But it was clanky. Things were clanking the whole time as the tanks rolled slightly backwards and forwards on their chains. And it was not smooth. I mean, being a flat-bottom craft, it plopped about on the water, and there was a constant spray coming over the front. So it wasn't comfortable, but it wasn't desperately uncomfortable. And all I could see was that all these other men of the regiment who had been through it all before, the landings of Sicily, the landings of Italy, were just taking it in their stride. So I had to then, I took my stance for them and sort of said, right, this is it. Anyway, as we came in, of course, we then all had to get inside the tanks, and you just had to wait them. At that time, I was acting as co-driver. I wasn't in the turret when I landed. Being a young recruit, all young, unblooded troopers, when they joined a unit, were invariably put into the co-driver's position. That meant that you became, I think, accustomed to the tank when you didn't have an awful lot to do, because the driver would drive. And so sitting in the co-driver's seat and looking out through the periscope, because that's all you had to look out, you then saw the front of the landing craft disappear into the water, and you could then look straight out at the beach, which was grey. To my surprise, not a lot of movement on the beach itself. It all seems, it had, of course, moved inland then, 2 or 3 miles inland. But as the tank came off the tank land craft and went down the gradient of the prow of the boat, all you could see through the periscope was the green water, which lapped up the front of the tank and then lapped over the periscope and came somewhere above driver level. And you just hope that the driver would be able to keep going. He was in bottom gear and stayed in bottom gear. The tank came off the front of the landing craft, levelled up slightly onto the seabed, and for what seemed like an eternity, just went forward in low gear until suddenly the water drained away from the periscope and one could see the beach. So we followed the troop leader's tank through the white lanes, which the engineers had already cleared of mines. And we then, I suppose it must have been 8 o'clock by this time, came off the beach, and the troop leader seemed to know where he was going. And we went inland for half a mile, came to the Liga area where we took off all the waterproofing. And it seemed quiet, so we were told we could brew up. So out came the petrol stoves and the compo ration of tea, and we brewed up. And we were standing there drinking our tea when there was a frightening roar overhead, and I looked up, and a Messerschmitt 109 came over so low that you could see the pilot looking out of his cockpit, wearing his leather helmet and his goggles, and you could almost see his eyes. And I was so astounded by this that by the time he'd gone and I turned round, there was not a soul to be seen. The other four members of the crew somehow had got underneath the tank, waited until the aircraft had gone, and emerged, but still holding their tea, which they hadn't spilled a drop of. And they looked a bit scathingly at me and said, well, you know, you won't last very long if you sort of just stand there like that. So it was a salutary lesson. I always was very conscious that if there's any noise about when you're outside the tank and you couldn't get into it, then you dived underneath it, holding your tea if you could.
So you had landed on D-Day, but not
no, on
H-hour.
D plus one, because we embarked on D-Day, but we arrived on June the 7th.
When you were underwater and going onto the beach, were you expecting to be blown up by a mine any minute?
Well, you thought that could happen. You just hope that, and you also hope that, because pushing, I think, visualizing pushing a tank through a lot of water requires quite a bit of power. You also only hope that you were on fairly solid sand and you weren't on something boggy, or that you weren't going to go down a bomb crater or a mine crater. But that was always the possibility. As far as I know, though, the whole of the squadron got off the tank landing crafts and met up in the Liga area without mishap.
What was your squadron?
Well, I was in A squadron of the 3rd County London Yeomanry. From that point on, my recollections become much less specific, because from that point on it was just a haze of moving backwards and forwards without ever knowing where you were. I'm sure the troop leader and the crew commander with their maps would know where one was, but when you're sitting inside a tank you just don't know where you are. You're told to go somewhere and you go. So the next few days is just a very hazy recollection of moving about but not actually being in a, I suppose you call, a fighting mode. And I began to wonder quite what it was all about. It all seemed a bit phony somehow. And in fact, you didn't actually, as I visualized that you're going to have a tank fighting a tank. In fact, I didn't see a German tank for weeks. Never saw one. They could see you because they were always in a defensive, dug-down position, and they weren't moving. So you could never see a German tank. They could keep you under observation, and invariably the first notice you had that, whilst you knew that in front of you were, you know, the German army, you couldn't see them. The first thing you knew was when your leading tank was hit, and maybe your second tank was hit before you knew what was happening. And every tank would then take some evasive action to find cover, and in that process you lost the possibility of where the German vehicle might have been. In any case, he probably moved off as soon as he'd known that he had hit something. So it was always a bit of a puzzle that I as a, certainly in that position as a driver operator, and then coming up into the turret subsequently as gunner, you very rarely saw a German tank. You would see German infantry in the distance that you could fire at, but you very rarely saw a German armoured fighting vehicle.